Why are rail users so unhappy? Let's talk to Bruce Williamson, who's from the campaign group Rail Futures and joins us now. Good afternoon, Bruce.
Hello, Julia.
This happens every year. Why is there a fuss every year that rail costs go up?
Well, obviously no one likes it when rail fares go up, but people accept the idea that there's inflation and that, you know, prices go up and their wages go up and their pensions go up and so on. What the problem is that the sort of disparity between the two, and I think in the news item someone mentioned that, you know, the rail fares are going up by much more than average wages, and it's down to this measure of inflation which the government chooses to use, which is RPI, which is a largely discredited figure for measuring inflation. Most people agree that CPI is the
more accurate consumer prices index.
Yeah, and I can't remember the technicalities of how they're both worked out, but the bottom line is this: CPI is lower. And that's how, you know, benefits and pensions and wages are sort of calculated normally. But of course, when it comes to rail fares, they use the higher figure, and they've used it year after year after year. So what this means is that, you know, that rail fares are going up in real terms. They're outpacing people's ability to pay for them, and we think that's unfair, and I think that's why passengers are quite rightly upset about this.
But no, for each pound that your fare goes on, we understand it's for each pound that's spent, 37 pence goes on tracks and trains, including leasing and fuel. We know fuel have gone up. 26 pence goes investment, and we know with lots of upgrading going on. 25 pence on staff, and we know rail staff are never shy of going on strike and getting those decent wages. 9p interest payments, 3 pence train company profits. We can see where the money's going. The reality is, look, a lot of people who spend a lot of money on their train fares tend to be, you know, season ticket commuters. They go, they move outside of a major city. They spend less to get a bigger home, live in a nice area, and then they commute into a big city. Why do they think that their train costs should be subsidised by everyone else?
Well, it's a difficult story. But okay, well, why not? Because of the environmental benefits, because the economy would grind to a halt if we didn't have railways.
No one's arguing for the end of the railways. I'm just saying that no one's subsidising my car journey.
They are, Julia. Oh. Let me give you some examples.
I don't drive to work, by the way, but
yeah, you know, I mean, the way that the taxes and the sort of financial structure of the railways versus the roads is set up is very unfair. You know. So, where do I start? Railways have to pay what's called rail fuel duty, and you might argue that that's fair enough because motorists do, but the road fuel duty is going to pay for the roads, whereas the rail fuel duty is going straight to the Treasury, and the railway train operating companies have to pay directly for running their trains on the track. Motorway policing is taken out of general taxation. The British Transport Police, the railway police, have to be paid for by the railway. And there are many, many other examples in which the odds are stacked against the railways. So, you know, if you look at the bigger picture, I mean, you can call it a subsidy if you like, but I think there's a very good argument that the roads are subsidised and pedestrians are paying for people to drive their cars.
But again, of course, we need both road and rail, whether it's about getting goods to the supermarkets that we buy or ourselves getting anywhere to and from work. I mean, we need both, don't we? Do you think the right balance is struck? By the sounds of it, you're saying no in terms of public subsidy, private costs, whether or not what percentage goes in profit, but also how much the passengers pay. Because there is that balance. I mean, once you own a car, you've got this massive sunk cost, and that's not subsidised. And then you're having to pay fuel duty and fuel. Basically, every time you use your car, you're almost getting better value out of it. I mean, I've got a car that sits outside the house for 6 days a week, 6.5 days, 3.75 days a week, to be honest with you. In which case, actually, you know, mine's getting very poor value. But whereas every train journey is an extra cost, which is different from every car journey.
Yeah, and you can understand why people drive their cars. You know, it's very convenient, and like you say, once you've sunk that cost into it, people tend not to factor in depreciation and servicing and all those other costs.
Oh, unless you use a car all the time, it's madness to own a car.
you could argue that. Yeah, I mean, I own a car. I don't think I'm mad, but anyway. but you know. So if you look at just the cost of fuel, this is the point. People look at the cost of fuel when they make a car journey, don't they? Whereas you know they don't consider all the knock-on costs, and they do look at the cost of a rail ticket, and it doesn't look like that attractive from that point of view. But if you look at it on an annual basis, it's more attractive. But I mean, you know, the general question you said about whether it's, you know, getting the balance right, I think we need to look at our sort of European neighbours, who generally speak. speaking, have a much more much lower rail fares and
much better service. And they have a much better service.
Well, indeed. Well, there you go. You pay your money, you take.
But that's not just down to huge extra investment. In fact, I mean, we spend more, I believe, subsidising our railways through the ridiculous system that we have, the way we have, they're sort of part privatised, than say the French, the Germans do. But look, the reality is, we had railways long before those other countries. Ours are very old. That's one of the reasons why there are these huge costs in terms of redevelopment. But also France and Germany. An awful lot of their infrastructure was destroyed, in the Second World War, and they had to start again from scratch. And therefore, they were able to start with, later technology. We are still being held back by the fact that we did it all first.
There is some truth in that, undoubtedly. When we have to modernise a Victorian station, there are huge costs in it, and obviously the electrification that has overrun on the Great Western is partly down to the fact that there's, underground things that we just don't know about. So perhaps, given that the RAF destroyed the French railways during World War II, they should sort of pay us a fee as a favour.
I'm going to insist to David Davis we make that part of the negotiations. I'm loving your work there, Bruce, loving it. Yeah, but this is it. I mean, we often make these comparisons, but are taxpayers in France and Germany, other countries, are they paying a load more for their system? My understanding is they're not. So what are we doing so wrong?
Well, I mean, I think you're right to point out the problem of privatisation, which has created, this structure. It's not so much that the train operating companies themselves are creaming off huge profits, because, as you said, it's only 3%, which is a fairly tight margin for the commercial sector. But it's the bureaucracy and the complexity of the system. You have so many people doing deals with each other and so many contracts and so many middlemen and so on. And that complexity has added to the cost of the privatised railway. And there was an argument, I think our Rail Future said, that if you're going to privatise it, you should privatise it wholesale as one big chunk, which would give those the economies of scale. But we are where we are. I suppose in a roundabout way, it's not Rail Future policy, but I do seem to be arguing for renationalisation.
Well, this is it. And there's a reason why a lot of people were very, very supportive of that when the Labour proposed it in the Labour manifesto ahead of June. Obviously, look, I'm someone who's very much in favour of the free market, except where there is a clear natural monopoly. And the idea that you can have in any way as competition on one railway line. I mean, okay, you can have slow trains and fast trains, so I'll get trains up north, and it's like you've got the Midlands line or you've got the Virgin line, and one of them is half the price of the other. You go, okay, fair enough, do I want to spend 3 hours on a journey? It could take one and a half. Well, it's a trade-off between time and money. But this is the reality, is that there's no real competition, and so you don't get any of the benefits of the market, but you get the downsides.
Well, you may well be true. I mean, I would argue that there is competition, though. I mean, there are some routes, such as London to Birmingham, where you have a choice of operators, and also you can take there are a few other examples as well. But I mean, generally, you're right.
Yeah, the competition is your car or taking a coach.
Well, but that's the point, you see. Yes, we still have the choice of car and plane and, maybe even walking and cycling as well. So the railways have a monopoly on rail transport, but they don't have a monopoly on transport. And so that's where the competition element comes in. And comparing it to motoring, I mean, the government, the Chancellor, fuel duty for motorists has been frozen for years and years and years now, hasn't it? Why is there this inconsistency? Why are the motorists?
I think because it went up so much at one point.
Well, you could say that about rail fares as well, couldn't you? But, it does seem that the government isn't treating rail passengers in the same way it's treating motorists. And I think that inconsistency seems to be pointed out here.
And partly, isn't that because people just tend to blame the rail companies for the prices? There might be an outcry when these things are announced, and then an outcry when the fares actually go up at the beginning of January, but then everyone else forgets about it.
Yeah, and I think we need to recognise that this is very much in the hands of the government. I mean, the poor old train operating companies have their hands tied in so many ways. They're really, if you like, doing the government's dirty work for them. And
God, I never thought you'd be on defending the...
defending the trade operating companies. Yeah, well, some are obviously better than others. And obviously we've spoken a lot about Southern, haven't we?
Oh, we have.
Over the last years. But, there are others such as Well, let's not name names, but some do have a very good reputation and are well loved by their passengers.
Well, indeed. See, we've ended on a positive note. We so rarely do that when we talk about
this. When we talk about railways.
Well, no, that's the thing. Genuinely, I live in London. I generally work in London, but sometimes, you know, when I'm doing those big long commuter journeys, I'm amazed by, like, you know, how good, you know, the trains are clean and the staff are friendly. They leave on time. I've got to be honest, had a pretty good experience. And as long as you're not, you know, doing the Sunday travel where you end up on a bus at some point, it's usually pretty good. Perhaps maybe we're a bit unrealistic, and we only moan about it, we only talk about it when it's gone wrong, otherwise we just pretend, you know, we just ignore it and forget about it. Bruce Williamson, always a pleasure, sir. He's from the campaign group Rail Futures.